The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8888. That's GSUGGSinsurance.com or phone number at 919-875-8889. Today's issue of Time Magazine is the double issue dated July 19/July 26, 2021. It contains the Olympic preview, and it features a portrait in black and white of, I'm not sure I can find that, it's Naomi Osaka, her first Olympics. This is in black and white. It's a young woman of color with her hair swooped back. She's wearing dangle earrings and a white shirt, looking at the camera lens but not smiling. Time, of course, is in large white block letters superimposed upon the photograph, and the front cover is, as usual, bordered in red. First of all, from the brief pages, a photograph here of a soldier in camouflage uniform carrying a weapon, standing behind a curlicued barbed wire fence, behind which are tall concrete walls built with panels, it would seem. There's a rather dilapidated building off to the left foreground, again behind the barbed wire, and there are two posts, tall posts of spotlights visible. Actually, I'm now counting four. One, two in the foreground, two in the middle background, one in the background. There is very little greenery, and what appears to be greenery also appears to be weeds, with more concrete structures, either fencing or actual buildings, in the background. The caption reads, "Vacated. An Afghan National Army soldier stands guard at the gate of Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan's Parwan province, the former center of the U.S. military presence in the country, July 2, the day the last U.S. troops vacated the facility and handed control to Afghan forces. The AP reported July 6, the final troops exited the base during the night without notifying its new commander. The full withdrawal of U.S. forces from the nation is nearly complete, following a February 2020 deal with the Taliban." And that caption was reported by Billy Perigo and Madeline Carlisle. Three short items under news ticker. Boy Scouts reach $850 million settlement. Tens of thousands of people involved in a lawsuit against the Boy Scouts of America alleging sexual abuse reached a $850 million settlement agreement with the organization July 1, the largest in a child sexual abuse case in the U.S. history. The group filed bankruptcy in 2020 in the face of rising allegations. Haiti's president was assassinated, Jovenel Moïse, assassinated in an attack on his private residence July 7. Opposition leaders had demanded Moïse step down, that's M-O-I-S-E, amid controversy over his rule by decree, but officials did not say who the perpetrators were. Supreme Court upholds voting limits. The U.S. Supreme Court upheld two controversial Arizona voting policies July 1. Critics say the ruling weakens the Voting Rights Acts of 1965. and will make it harder to challenge laws restricting the time and manner of voting that have been passed in 17 states this year. The larger article on this page is under the headline Nation. Britney Spears' case highlights flaws in conservatorship system. In emotional testimony to a court in Los Angeles, June 23, pop star Britney Spears asserted publicly for the first time she wants to end the conservatorship she's been placed under for 13 years. Her legal guardians have dictated where she lives, works, and receives therapy, Spears claimed, forced her to take medication, prevented her from removing her IUD. Now, disability advocates who have long fought to reform conservatorships hope the high-profile case can inspire changes to the system. Conservatorships, also called guardianships, are typically used for elderly adults or people with mental illnesses or intellectual or developmental disabilities. They're intended to be protective mechanisms by which a court-appointed conservator makes decisions for individuals deemed incapable of managing their own affairs. It is supposed to be a last resort because it is so invasive, says Zoe Brennan Crone, staff attorney at the ACLU's Disability Rights Project. But in reality, it's very often the first resort. And once a conservatorship is in place, there's little oversight and it's difficult to end. A judge first granted Spears' father control over her finances and personal life in 2008 amid concerns about her mental health and alleged substance abuse. A professional conservator and wealth management firm were later added. After Spears' testimony, the firm asked to resign. Her manager and court-appointed lawyer resigned, and her mother said Spears should get to choose her own lawyer. The next hearing in Spears' case will have been July 14. Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bob Casey have called for more data on guardianships and alternatives in light of Spears' situation. If people are stripped of their rights, they cannot learn to make decisions, says Jonathan Martinez, a disability rights lawyer at Syracuse University, and their mistakes can be used against them. Today, advocates are promoting a model called supported decision-making, which lets individuals build a network of people whom they trust to help make their choices, instead of conservatorship. Every time we shine a little bit of light, things get easier for everyone after that, Martinez says. Brittany's not just shining a light, she's a huge spotlight. And that was written by Abigail Abrams. Here's the seven questions page. Ely Honig, the former prosecutor, on his new book, Hatchet Man, Why Bill Barr Went So Wrong and What It Will Take to Clean Up Justice. Philip Elliott wrote this, and I may not be pronouncing his name correctly. I'll spell it E-L-I-E, Ely, H-O-N-I-G, Honig. Question, you don't mince words here. In the introduction to your book, you call Bill Barr a liar and a political partisan with an extremist dystopian worldview. At what point did you come to this conclusion? Answer, as to the part about having this dystopian worldview, that was something I only came to later, when I was trying to piece together the question that so many people ask, which is, why would Bill Barr have taken this job in the first place? Bill Barr sees himself really as a culture warrior, as somebody whose ultimate mission was not so much to enforce criminal laws of the United States fairly and impartially, but to impose his own extremist worldview, where the only true way to govern societies is with religious belief at the forefront and secularism is the root of all evil. Question. You were in the same boat as a lot of us here in D.C. in that we overlooked what was incoming when Barr was nominated. How did we get that wrong? Answer. I point the finger at myself there. I happened to be on CNN the day his name was announced. I said something like, he's serious and he's respected and he should be a real upgrade from Jeff Sessions. I did not have knives out and ready for him from the start. Question. Time and time again, we saw things that scholars and practitioners like yourself called wrong, if not outright constitutional. Why did nothing matter? Answer. We as a country vest enormous powers in our prosecutors. The Attorney General holds the most powers of any prosecutor, and so much of our system depends on trusting in prosecutorial judgment and discretion and goodwill. I was taught from a very early age at DOJ that a good prosecutor can do the most good of virtually anyone in public service, and a bad prosecutor can do a huge amount of harm. Question. Prosecutors' credibility is the cornerstone of the whole system. How does Attorney General Merrick Garland get us back to that place? Answer. I have been critical of Merrick Garland thus far. I think Garland has not been strong enough, has not been aggressive enough in correcting the abuses of Barr and the Trump administration. Garland has made clear that he wants to avoid causing political turbulence at virtually all costs. Question. Did Trump hire the absolute worst attorneys available to him? Answer. You are entitled in your personal capacity to hire whoever you want. You suffer the consequences. But when it comes to picking the government's top lawyers, whether it's White House counsel or, most importantly, Attorney General, I think you run into a real problem when you're searching for your Roy Cohn. And I think it's quite clear Bill Barr's audition memo reached Donald Trump and he liked it. In Donald Trump's mind, he had his Roy Cohn. Question, did Bill Barr know better? Answer. He had to have known better. This is a smart man. This is a deeply experienced man. This is a man who was Attorney General once before. He appeared to be an institutionalist. When he got in office this time, though, he really went off the rails. Question. Talking about the Roger Stone case, this was the one time in the 80,000 cases that DOJ handles a year that the AG stepped in. Would a jury convict A.G. Barr for, say, misconduct on that circumstantial evidence? Answer. I do not think Barr committed a crime in intervening in the Stone case. The Attorney General technically has the right to ask for a lower sentence. It is just outrageous that he did that. It is an abuse of his power. Next page is Time Out Reviews, television. XOXO Gen Z. Gossip Girl was supposed to be gone forever. By the time its anonymous Upper East Side dirt disher issued a final XOXO in 2012, ratings for the briefly generation-defining CW teen drama had nosedived, perhaps because the recession had made ostentatious wealth uncool. But just as younger millennials did with Friends, Gen Z embraced the show without any expectation of realism. Now, as part of its ongoing courtship of that cohort, HBO Max has revived the brand. Tailored to today's teens, this GG, or Gossip Girl, is less problematic and more superficially diverse. In place of Serena and Blair, the central frenemies are girls of color, benevolent influencer Julian Jordan Alexander, and her estranged scholarship student half-sister Zoya Whitney Peake, late of Buffalo. The Lothario is a bisexual party boy, Thomas Doherty, and with teachers driving Instagram drama, the series is less about feuding mean girls than it is about people who know better than to get lured into that fray. Showrunner Joshua Safran, who wrote for the original, keeps the Whartonian camp flowing, but the toned-down boys are bland, and new love interests lack chemistry. Still, it is a surprisingly fine for a show that should not exist. Gossip Girl is streaming on HBO Max. Here's a movie, Street of Nightmares. The 1990s were a golden age for youth-oriented horror. Teens had flocked to drive-in creature features for decades, but the huge cohort growing up in the calm between the Cold War and 9/11, sought scares in every medium. Scream and I Know What You Did Last Summer launched franchises, while teens got hooked on Buffy. Their kid siblings devoured Are You Afraid of the Dark? Books by R.L. Stine and Christopher Pike got passed around schools like contraband. Now, because the search for monetized intellectual property never ends, Netflix is revisiting that era with a movie trilogy based on Stine's Fear Street. Less iconic than the author's middle-grade Goosebumps books, this bloodier, more mature teen series, which Stine revived in 2014, is set in fictional Shadyside, a normal suburb, except for one street afflicted by a centuries-old curse. The moderately entertaining, nostalgia-soaked Fear Street trilogy of filmmaker Lee Janiak, Honeymoon, shifts the premise slightly. In the first film, set in 1994, Shadyside's a hellhole, scorned by its stuck-up sports rival Sunnyvale. Following a gory intro at a deserted mall that recalls Drew Barrymore's turn in Scream, a story coalesces around an angsty Shadyside band geek, Kiana Madeira's Dina, whose ex-girlfriend, Olivia Scott Welch, has moved to Sunnyvale and started dating a football star. When a thoughtless act of revenge awakens an ancient evil, Dina and her friends must dig into the dark history of their hometown to save themselves. This makes for well-paced, culturally literate, if generic, slasher fare. Set at a summer camp in 1978, the second and tighter of the two movies sent for review owes much to Friday the 13th. The last installment will turn the clock back to 1666. Along with references ranging from Carrie to Castlevania, no-brainer music sinks abound. Nine Inch Nails in 94, Carry On, Wayward Son in 78, the presence of Stranger Things, Sadie Sink and Maya Hawke, should ensure youth appeal. Although this formulaic approach is no surprise, I had hoped for something less calculated. The Fear Street movies are nothing more, but also nothing less, than a competent streaming algorithm copy of the forgettable flicks teens with fewer viewing options once rented on VHS. And another review headlined Television. Here is a group of people, five people, standing on a what looks like black lava sand beach. They're waving. A man, a woman, another woman, another woman, and a man. There's water behind them, as in a cove. There are palm trees behind the water on the other side, and a few houses, and behind that are very tall mountains with no greenery on them. This is Vacation, All They Never Wanted by Judy Berman. Again, it's television. Vacation is no panacea. It's a break from work, sure, for those who can log off. But our real troubles, the ones that infect our most intimate relationships, cannot be checked at the front desk of any five-star hotel. They follow us like human remains in the cargo hold of a plane packed with tourists. This grim metaphor constitutes the opening scene of The White Lotus, a darkly funny, existentially terrifying HBO miniseries from writer, director, and actor Mike White. In a Hawaii airport, a couple interrogates a somber-looking man, affable Jake Lacey in frat boy mode, about his honeymoon at the White Lotus Resort. Our guide told us someone was killed there. the woman exclaims. Yes, says the groom. The body's being loaded onto the plane. Then they ask where his bride is. Though it's tempting to theorize, the show takes its time returning to who died and how. Flashing back to a week earlier, it follows a handful of VIPs, including Lacey's Shane and his wife, struggling journalist Rachel Alexandra Daddario, at the resort. If the newlyweds bring their incompatibility as baggage, then weepy Tanya, an astounding Jennifer Coolidge, has only her mother's ashes to declare. Trailing powerful executive Nicole, Connie Britton, are her emasculated husband Mark, Steve Zahn, their screen-addicted teen son, Quinn, Fred Heckinger, and their snarky socialist daughter, Olivia, Euphoria's Sydney Sweeney, who's brought a college pair, pal, Brittany O'Grady. The girls are as hypocritical. Olivia calls Hillary Clinton a neo-lib and a neo-con, as they are hilarious. Coordinating their stay is resort manager Armand Murray Bartlett, smooth with guests and exacting but philosophical with staff. He starts to unravel when a new hire goes into labor. Armand's idea of good service is aptly infantilizing. Guests, he says, get everything they want, but they don't even know what they want. No one understands this better than spa director Belinda Natasha Rothwell, whose compassion charms Tanya. Yes, this is a hell is other people story. What makes it thrilling is the way it filters that conceit through White's singular sensibility. Like his previous HBO show, cult classic Enlightened, The White Lotus is uniquely attuned to characters' internal conflicts, their varying levels of self-awareness, and how that inner life shapes their interactions. Shane has no idea he's a jerk. Tanya knows she's a disaster and tries to warn others. Staffers do not have the freedom to blurt out their own private thoughts. It's when the appetites and resentments they have repressed come to the surface that the White Lotus spins out of control. There are political elements at play. While the guests are mostly white and straight, the staff is indigenous, black, and queer. The lofty principles characters espouse dovetail conveniently with their own self-interest. Olivia clearly bashes Hillary to rile her mom, but would she or any of the guests truly give up their privilege if given the chance? For all its insights, the White Lotus is still a summer vacation romp. It uses the Polynesian backdrop to its fullest. In a luau sequence, the drums and dancing heighten the intensity and absurdity of each dinner conversation. The finely tuned performances heighten the pleasure. Much of the humor comes from having characters so vivid we can sense when they are struggling to maintain outward calm while raging internally. It's an approach Succession fans will surely appreciate. If the butt of that show's jokes is corporate decadence, then White, who brings more empathy to his satire, has equally profound things to say about the politics of leisure. Even better, he never makes getting to those revelations feel like work. And here's the caption for the photo I described earlier. The long-suffering staff of the White Lotus greets the latest boatload of guests. Under Nation comes this article. On June 7, 2007, Joshua James earned a Purple Heart for his service in Iraq. And there's a photo here of a young serviceman standing in front of flags. He's in the camouflage uniform, and holding a framed certificate, the writing of which is not legible in this photo. From combat to conspiracy, on January 6, 2021, he joined the siege of the U.S. Capitol by Vera Bergengruen, Arab Alabama, and W.J. Hennigan. The second photo is very dark, of a man dressed in dark clothing with some kind of gear strapped on, with like backpack straps. He's yelling at something, and the white pillars of the interior of the Capitol are in the background of the view. The crackle of handheld radios broke the morning stillness sound carries in the country, and on the rural outskirts of Arab, Alabama, curious neighbors stepped onto their porches, craning their necks to see what was going on. Some thought the police had found an escaped inmate who'd been a leading story on local news. But even from afar, there was no mistaking the outsize yellow letters on the uniformed figures entering the single-story house at the end of the two-lane road, FBI. The word spread quickly. Claudia Schultz was walking out of her jewelry shop on the town's small main street when another store owner told her Joshua James had been arrested. Schultz was incredulous. Josh? You mean our Josh? In Arab, a town of 8,380, in northeastern Alabama, much of the community knew James, 34, as a soft-spoken, God-fearing family man with three young kids who ran his own pressure-washing business. Those who knew him better considered him a local hero, an Army combat veteran and Purple Heart recipient who got choked up when he talked to local teenagers about enlisting in the U.S. military. But the federal agents who showed up on James's doorstep March 9 described a very different man, an extremist who had not just broken the law but carried out an assault on the same government he'd sworn to defend as a soldier. For weeks, James had helped plan an operation to disrupt the certification, January 6, of President Joe Biden's electoral victory, investigators say. By coordinating and recruiting others to travel to Washington with paramilitary gear, including guns, tactical vests, helmets, radio equipment, a federal conspiracy indictment contends James and at least 15 other members of the Oath Keepers and anti-government militia had organized, equipped, and trained ahead of the siege that left five dead and dozens more injured. James was among the throngs of supporters of defeated President Donald Trump, who rammed their way into the seat of American democracy. "Get out of my Capitol," James allegedly shouted at riot officers. "This is my F Space King building." For many, reconciling the war hero and family man with the January 6 insurrectionist is not easy. Federal prosecutors have described the Capitol rioters as a fringe group of violent extremists, conspiracy theorists, and madmen. The man presiding over James's case professed bafflement. "Mr. James, I've got to tell you, I'm not sure of why anyone in your position, given the life you've led, would do this," D.C. District Judge Amit Mehta told him at an April hearing. If James's decision to leave his family to join an attack on the U.S. Capitol is a mystery, there are clues to what drove him. After his service and rehabilitation from his injuries, he struggled to rebuild his life. In that, he was not alone. Of the more than 500 people arrested in connection with the January 6 riot, at least one in 10 was a current or former member of the U.S. military, according to a George Washington University analysis. Many had served in the protracted post-9/11 conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, returning home to a country that paid them lip service but moved on without much notice to the wars they had fought. Over time, James found community in the Oath Keepers, which used the familiar terminology and camaraderie of military life to mobilize vets in support of a variety of right-wing causes. In doing so, prosecutors allege, its members miscast criminality as patriotism. The communications between James and other veterans January 6 were full of phrases like "Save the Republic" and "Defend America," according to court filings. Many claimed they'd been betrayed by U.S. politicians, who were the true enemies of the state. The insurrectionists' grievances were so strong, prosecutors allege, they took the law into their own hands. But this view has found strong support across the country. In Arab, where American and Confederate flags compete for space on some front porches with "Make America Great Again" banners, more than two dozen residents describe the events of January 6 to Time as a legitimate protest over an election they wrongly believed to have been fraudulent. Yes, it got out of hand, they say, but many saw James as a man motivated by love of country, exercising First Amendment rights, who was ensnared in a politicized witch hunt. "I quite frankly believe him to be an American hero," says Rachel Ann Holligan, who lives close to the Jameses in Arab. "The corruption and fraud that's being perpetrated by our government is absurd." This account is based on interviews with more than two dozen friends, neighbors, and community members in Arab. People who knew James through his military service and business dealings, his archives, social media posts, and a review of FBI and federal prosecutors' legal filings. James's guilt or innocence will be determined at trial. Federal prosecutors will present evidence he violated multiple laws in an insurrection against the country he had sworn to defend. But the forces that fed James' alleged insurrection may be too deep-rooted to be resolved by the trials. In many communities like Arab, the radical path James took January 6 seems patriotic rather than criminal. For some, the law itself seems almost a sideshow. "Everyone has the right to stand up for what they believe," says Ramsey Vandergriff, a 38-year-old electrician. "It could easily have been me. It could easily have been any of us." "I'm a normal dude," James tells the camera in a video posted to his wife Audrey's TikTok account in early June. He plants kisses on her cheek and turns back to the grill as she films them in their yard. "Just a normal man," she repeats, punctuating her words with exasperated sighs. A Purple Heart recipient, veteran, grilling dinner for his family. Audrey tells her new followers she cannot reveal much more since posting about James's arrest and her family's ordeal. She has gained a sympathetic audience of more than 18,000 on the social app. But the video pans out to show the ankle monitor that's tracked James's movement since April. "The FBI is kind of crazy," she says. "It is unreal every single day." Both James and his wife declined interviews for this story, citing ongoing court proceedings. He has pleaded not guilty. The man in these posts comes across as a devoted dad and husband with a wry sense of humor, who likes fishing, grilling, and secretly watching the Golden Girls. He occasionally jumps into Instagram videos advertising Audrey's real estate business. The oldest of six siblings, James grew up in San Jose, California, playing football and the guitar. As he approached the end of high school 4 years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks, he decided to follow in his uncle's footsteps and enlist in the Army, motivated by the idea of serving his country, while also setting up a stable life for himself. Before he deployed to Iraq, March 2007, at the height of the U.S. military surge, he got a tattoo on his right forearm, "Death before dishonor." June 7, the 19-year-old Army private was in the turret of his armored truck outside Baghdad. His 8-man unit had spent hour after eye-glazing hour staring at the arid terrain, hunting for signs of buried roadside bombs. Suddenly the road erupted into a fireball. A dump truck full of 2,000 pounds of homemade explosives blew the bridge in half that my squad was on, Sergeant David Aleman, the unit's squad leader, tells Time. The blast killed three and wounded several others, including Aleman. It rocked James's head and neck, shattering his jaw, as the column of a nearby building collapsed on him. Smoke and blood filled James's nostrils. Scrambling in the chaos, someone in the unit managed to radio for medical support. It is a miracle, Aleman says, that some of us survived. For James, the months that followed were a blur of surgeries and physical therapy sessions, first in Europe, then in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, before he settled in Florida. His body slowly healed, but he was forced to take medical retirement from the Army and struggled to adapt to post-military life. He suffered from PTSD, anxiety, and depression as his personal relationships came under strain, according to legal filings. In 2011, James was charged with prowling when he was found handing out flyers for a moving company in a gated parking lot in Jacksonville. He faced a felony charge of impersonating a law enforcement officer after police said he falsely claimed he was a member of the military police. The charges were ultimately dropped. Things finally started falling into place on the night in 2014 when he took Audrey on a first date to a comedy club. She later posted on Facebook that she laughed so loud she embarrassed him. The two had met years earlier, when Audrey was still married to another soldier and James's jaw was still wired shut. She would later joke to friends she liked it better that way. They married in 2016. Taking a break here from the text, there's another photo here of the iconic dome and porticos of the United States Capitol building with a flag flying atop the balcony by the dome. There's a throng of people crowding around it and moving into it, and the caption reads, at least 10% of the people arrested in connection with the siege at the Capitol were current or former military members. Returning to the text, all the while, James's prior military service remained an important part of his life. He became involved with local chapters of the Oath Keepers in Central Florida, whose recruiting materials reminded members that their oath was forever. America's veterans truly are like a sleeping giant. It's time to awaken them and fill them with a terrible resolve to defeat the domestic enemies of our Constitution, says one chapter's mission statement, according to documents reviewed by Time. If we cannot get the veterans to step up to save our republic, then how can we expect to get the rest of our people to do what must be done? September 2017, James traveled to the Florida Keys with members of the group to help disaster relief efforts after Hurricane Irma devastated the area. He volunteered to drive one of the trucks, delivering pallets of rice and beans. As Oath Keepers, we are on location helping by any means necessary, he wrote in a now-deleted Instagram post with the hashtags Patriots, Selfless, and For the People. Videos posted to YouTube at the time show him standing next to the local chapter's self-professed leader, Kelly Meggs, passing out water bottles to locals. In 2018, Joshua and Audrey moved their newborn son and Audrey's two children from her previous marriage to her hometown of Arab to be closer to her family. There he received treatment through Veterans Affairs and launched American Pro Hydro Services, a pressure washing business that advertises with patriotic red, white, and blue logos that it is veteran-owned. James also seemed to stay in touch with members of the Oath Keepers back in Florida and make connections with new ones in the region. On social media, his wife referred to James's network of fellow vets / retired police, seemingly in reference to the Oath Keepers, but with no active chapters near him, James seemed to drift toward right-wing spaces online. His YouTube habits mixed fishing and cooking accounts with a range of far-right conspiracy and survivalist channels. On Pinterest, he saved images of American flags and eagles with quotes like, "I have the right to bear arms. Your approval is not required." His page included posts linked to sites like Patriot Depot, which advertises supplies for the conservative revolution, alongside styling ideas for his daughter's hair. By 2020, even the professional social media presence of the pressure-washing business James had painstakingly built had started to slip. Invoke the Insurrection Act now. The handle for American Pro-Hydro tweeted at Trump in August 2020 in response to the president's tweets about racial justice protests. The following month, James joined Parler, that's P-A-R-L-E-R, a largely right-wing social media site where he followed a slate of conservative figures, accounts like the conspiracy website InfoWars and fellow Oath Keepers. Looking forward to meeting everyone, he posted September 8. After the election, James began traveling with the Oath Keepers to events in Texas, Georgia, and D.C. to provide security for right-wing speakers, including longtime Trump advisor Roger Stone, retired General Michael Flynn, and conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. These trips were frequent enough that his wife received $1,500 in several payments from January to March from an Oath Keepers account through a mobile cash app to help support my children while he was not there, according to her March 11 deposition. November 21, James attended a Stop the Steal rally in Atlanta, where speakers urged participants to accept nothing less than a Donald Trump victory. A photo from the event shows him wearing a bulletproof vest with the Oath Keepers logo and the motto, "Guardians of the Republic / Not on Our Watch." Although James deleted most of his social media, an archived version of his Parler account shows his posts were peppered with hashtags like Stop the Steal 2020, Save America, and Deep State Corruption. He posted a photo from a Stop the Steal rally in front of the White House November 14 with the caption, "Communists and CCP loyalists want to change our way of life." It was a dramatic evolution for a man who had not been registered to vote before 2015 and only joined the NRA the following year. Friends and neighbors never thought of James as particularly political beyond holding the standard conservative views that are common in Arab, which is in the nation's most conservative congressional district. As with other veterans whose involvement in right-wing groups like the Oath Keepers led them to the Capitol January 6, James' descent into alleged extremism seemed less an expression of long-held political fervor than the desire to be part of a larger patriotic cause. I'm pausing again for photos. James is shown here with a fellow Oath Keepers escort to a rally in Washington the night before the insurrection. They are escorting former Trump advisor Roger Stone, who is apparent in the photo toward the back. He's wearing a bright blue and white pinstripe suit and even brighter blue shirt, of blue and red and black striped tie. He's wearing quite a stylish hat atop his head. That's Mr. Stone. James is wearing this gear on top of a hoodie with a mask and a black hat, khaki trousers, a black hoodie, I guess, with a black jacket, and again this strapped-on gear. Then there's another happier photo here. It's a pretty bride wearing white and carrying a bouquet of lilac-colored roses, and a young man wearing light khaki trousers and a white shirt with long sleeves and a blue tie, and he's wearing one of the pale lilac roses as a boutonniere, smiling, broad, both of them are smiling, and it's James with Audrey on their wedding day in October 2016. Returning to the text, little data is kept, should be, are kept on how often and why veterans get involved with extremist groups, but there are plenty of high-profile examples throughout American history. Nathan Bedford Forrest, a Confederate Army general, was the first Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. George Lincoln Rockwell, a Navy veteran, founded the American Nazi Party. Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols, both Army veterans, were convicted of the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. Founded by a former Army paratrooper in 2009, the Oath Keepers has quickly become one of America's largest anti-government extremist groups. It heavily recruits current and former military and law enforcement members, encouraging them to see themselves as the last line of defense against tyranny, according to Oath Keepers websites. The group's name refers to the oath sworn by members of the military and law enforcement to defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Some members falsely believe the federal government has been taken over by a cabal of elites actively trying to strip American citizens of their rights, according to the FBI. Groups like the Oath Keepers exploit the sense of isolation that plagues many returning combat veterans. Most U.S. service members have no ties to extremist organizations, but the government has long warned about such groups' desire to enlist returning veterans into their ranks to exploit their tactical skills and combat experience. A 2009 Department of Homeland Security assessment said right-wing extremists will attempt to recruit and radicalize returning veterans in order to boost their violent capabilities. This disaffection is often particularly acute for soldiers of James's generation, who served in America's longest wars as the country gradually became more detached from overseas conflicts, says Kathleen Bellew, author of Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. The Oath Keepers peddles an opportunity to continue their service. Militia groups have really familiar structures of command, Bellew says. They have structures of fraternal bonding. They have organizational social elements that are very similar to the armed forces, and they are built that way deliberately. Prosecutors say James's main contact at the Capitol was Kelly Meigs, with whom he had distributed disaster relief aid in 2017. According to federal investigators, the Florida militia leader not only organized the Oath Keepers, but also planned to join forces with other extremist groups, including the Proud Boys and Three Percenters, January 6. Court filings in James's case portray him as a key figure in the plan to storm the Capitol. Chats with other Oath Keepers on the encrypted messaging app Signal demonstrate the defendant was designated as a leader in the group, and he operated as one early on, according to prosecutors. James allegedly fielded messages from other men in Alabama eager to join his Quick Reaction Force, QRF, team. When one said he had friends near D.C. willing to help with a lot of weapons and ammo if you get in trouble, James responded, according to prosecutors, "That might be helpful, but we have a SH space load of QRF on standby with an arsenal." On Parler, James chatted with Roberto Minuta, a New York tattoo artist and member of the Oath Keepers. "I've been hoarding any ammo I can get my hands on, LOL," Minuta responded in December to a photo James had posted of his guns and ammunition. Around 2:30 p.m. January 6, James and Minuta were allegedly spotted on security cameras speeding toward the Capitol in two golf carts as James shouted directions from the map on his phone. While they made their way, a group of 7 oath keepers were preparing to climb the Capitol's east stairs in a tactical formation, according to the federal indictment. To pierce the mass of people gathered there, each group member placed a hand on the back of the person ahead, a military-style tactic prosecutors called a stack. The group forcibly entered through the Capitol doors, where James and Minuta followed 25 minutes later. "Patriots storming the Capitol building," said Minuta, according to prosecutors. "F Space King war in the streets right now." Investigators say James exchanged at least 10 calls and texts that day with fellow militia members, nearly all of whom were clad in tactical vests, helmets, and other gear, while terrified lawmakers inside the building hid and ran for their lives. In the process, prosecutors allege, James had broken multiple laws barring conspiracy, obstruction, and entering a restricted building. In Arab, the chaos in Washington felt far away. A town that was named after a typo, it was meant to honor the founder's son, Arad, A-R-A-D, Thompson. But the U.S. Postal Service misspelled the name in 1882, and the mistake stuck. The community decided to lean into the moniker, referring to their football team as the Arabian Nights. Arabs, 98% white, with more than 36 evangelical churches, and what locals fondly refer to as strong traditional values. Stores in town sell Rulers of the South memorabilia, featuring Confederate generals. It holds an annual Back When Day to demonstrate 1800s quilting, cornmeal grinding, and blacksmithing. When James quietly returned to Arab from the Capitol, he resumed his life as normal. He pressure-washed driveways, posed for selfies Valentine's Day, donned a tie for Audrey's real estate banquet, and collected disaster relief supplies with fellow veterans after a deadly tornado in Fultondale, Alabama. But privately, James seemed to grasp the gravity of the situation. 2 days after the insurrection, he encouraged other oath keepers to delete and destroy their communications on Signal, texting them to make sure that all Signal comms about the op had been deleted and burned, according to federal investigators. 62 days later, a new customer rang James's phone in need of a pressure-washing job. It was a ruse. While he was away, FBI agents with the local sheriff and police in tow rumbled up to his front door in a vehicle neighbors described as a tank. After asking James's wife and 3-year-old son to step out of the house, they demanded to know if he was building a bomb. Then they flew a drone inside to make sure. For 8 hours, they searched the family's 1,300-square-foot home, rummaging through closets, cabinets, and garage boxes. James was arrested and charged with crimes, carrying a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison. Skipping to the end now, James has been living under house arrest, allowed to leave only for mental health appointments. In May, during what would be a busy season for his business, his company truck sat idle in the backyard. At least 3 co-defendants in the Oathkeeper case have pleaded guilty to charges of conspiracy and obstructing Congress and are now cooperating with the government. These witnesses' testimony could have a major impact on James's case. Over the July 4 weekend, Audrey pored over their plea deals with a highlighter to understand what it might mean for her husband. Sounding incredulous, she told her TikTok followers that she was blown away at the constitutional rights they're signing away. Even though his fellow oath keepers had pleaded guilty, she maintained James had done nothing wrong on January 6. This article was written by Vera Bergengruen, Arab, Alabama, and W.J. Hennigan, with reporting by Simone Shaw, New York, and Chris Wilson. Here's a photo to describe. It's 2 pages. It's at night. There are probably concrete block and corrugated metal buildings in the background and some street lights, only a few, trees in the background, but in the foreground a lot of green grass, and a lot of small lights right on the ground. The caption reads, "Shining a light at the site of the former Mary Avil Indian Residential School in Saskatchewan. Unmarked graves were designated with flags and solar lamps ahead of a vigil held by the Kowesis First Nation June 27. As many as 751 sets of human remains were found on the grounds of the residential school, one of 139 across Canada that for more than a century Indigenous youth were forced to attend as part of assimilation programs." The photograph is by Amru Salahuddin. The remains of nearly 400 more children have been found at two other former residential schools in British Columbia. A 2015 report funded by the Canadian government as part of a settlement with thousands of former students and their descendants acknowledged at least 4,000 deaths at the schools, which it termed cultural genocide. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.